This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening on this sad and unsettling day for any journalist who's entered a war zone to report for the United States or anyone else in the world. Today, President Obama wanted to keep the focus on Ukraine, NATO, and Russia during his visit to Estonia, but it was not to be. He took time here during his news conference to pay tribute to slain journalist Stephen Sutloff.
Whatever these murderers think they'll achieve by killing innocent Americans like Stephen, they have already failed. They failed because, like people around the world, Americans are repulsed by their barbarism. We will not be intimidated. Their horrific acts only unite us as a country and stiffen our resolve to take the fight against these terrorists. And those who make the mistake of harming Americans will learn that we will not forget and that our reach is long and that justice will be served.
President Obama speaking today from Estonia about another video from the Islamic State. Another presidential reaction, a video which mentioned President Obama repeatedly by name in a kind of playground taunt, showing images of his vacation in Martha's Vineyard in a propaganda play that seemed to be an emblem of the internet age. But what now? U.S. journalist Stephen Sutloff is dead. The global focus is on the nasty British-accented Jihad John, who has apparently carried out both of these killings, Foley and now Sutloff. Sutloff was remembered today as a sincere, hardworking journalist who wrote for Time magazine, the Christian Science Monitor, and Foreign Policy. He vanished in Syria in August of 2013. So now what? Gary Sick is a senior research scholar at Columbia University. He served on the National Security Council under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan and was the principal White House aide for Iran during the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis. Gary Sick, welcome back to The Takeaway.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, John.
Can you glean any sense of strategy and method here in this Islamic State approach to the United States and the West right now?
Well, I think we've learned several things about this organization. First, it doesn't resemble in any way, say, the hostage takers in Iran or the hostage takers in Lebanon or even the Palestinians, all of whom wanted to use the hostages for leverage. And in this case, they've given away their leverage. They've killed their hostage, and it means that they're more interested in shock, the pure shock value. And basically, you know, what terrorists do, the reason they have their name, is they strike terror. And I think that's what they're after. They really want to frighten people and intimidate people. And unfortunately, unfortunately, somebody is paid with their life, and that's a horrible situation. But the reality is their system isn't working, that basically they're making decisions in a sort of apocalyptic way, and in fact is having exactly the reverse effect.
Well, I'm sure you share my thoughts of condolences that go out to the Sutloff family, yet without commenting on the morality of the human race, I mean, at a time like this, as these brutal videos accumulate, this shock value that you're talking about has to go down on some level. And, you know, America joins the rest of the world where in most places, the idea of terrorism is much more familiar than it is here in our country.
The thing about taking hostages is that it is a very personal act. And it actually, they're right, in fact, to focus on Obama because the president of the United States is a human being. And he feels a great deal of responsibility for other Americans. And by basically attacking him personally, they are basically saying, we don't care about you guys. We aren't interested in dealing with you. We're simply going to ignore you and we're going to kill you. And that is it's a very powerful message. They really, unfortunately, truly, fortunately, don't have the power to back that up. And I think that is the key issue here.
You know, this is such a grim conversation, but I'm thinking back a few weeks to the downing of the Malaysian jet in Ukraine. I mean, that was seen as such a horrible escalation of the conflict, yet it's almost vanished in the noise of what's gone on here. As you remember the 444 days of the Iranian hostage crisis, was there a period when the length of time the hostages was being held diminished their value, diminished the negotiating power of the Iranians on some level. Could you see an end game?
The longer it went on, the more effect it had on the American people. This is something that was played out nightly on American TV. This was actually the hostage crisis in Iran was the first televised U.S. foreign policy crisis, and it played out on live television every night. That kept it alive. That actually kept that in front of people's minds, and so you had yellow ribbons being tied to trees all over the United States. It didn't lose its effect. And again, it's because it is such a personal thing. These are human beings, very specific named human beings. It's not a group of people being killed in some odd place. You know these people. You learn their stories. And for that reason, it does have a tremendous amount of power. There's no two ways about it.
As you look at what's transpired over the last 2 weeks, is the Islamic State committing acts of desperation, or is there some sort of escalation going on here that leads somewhere?
I think they're in a different zone. They believe what they're saying. And that is, we've run into this with people who are truly fanatics in a variety of places. And that scares people because they lose their humanity. They basically are willing to commit suicide if necessary, literally, to make a point. And I think that's what they're doing. But it's our job to assist them in that process. If they're going to destroy themselves, I think we have every reason to try to make that as easy as possible for them. And I think that's, in fact, the way that is the end game. That's where it's going.
But revenge and explicit acts of retribution, targeting, for instance, this Jihad John fellow, that would be a mistake strategically?
Well, I think there's a short term and a long term. The short term, if you could get that guy and bring him to justice, I think that would be a marvelous thing. It's very unlikely to be able to get your hands on him. But the longer term one is to put together an effective coalition, because what ISIS is doing is bringing together people like Iran and Saudi Arabia, who normally don't even talk to each other, or the two different sides or multiple sides in the Iraqi government. Those people now see ISIS as a threat beyond anything that they saw before, and suddenly they're prepared to cooperate with each other. And I think that it's a moment for us to act as a sort of facilitator to bring that together, to in fact provide a multiple coalition to squeeze these guys, to close off their access to the rest of the world, and to put them under pressure.
There's a takeaway from Gary Six, senior research scholar at Columbia University. He served on the National Security Council under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan, the principal White House aide for Iran during the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis. Gary Six, thanks as always.
It was a real pleasure, John.
You know, I love this program, and there's many things I love about this program, but one of the things I really love about this program is when we start a conversation, you sometimes just run with it in a big way. So yesterday when we had this conversation with Mark Linus, a scientist visiting fellow at Cornell University, about the science behind genetically modified food, GMOs, and the lack of science, he says, behind the critics of GMOs, many of you were listening intently. First, here's Mark Linus.
What it comes down to essentially is a sort of romantic appeal to the naturalistic fallacy, the idea that natural is always good. I think in industrialized countries, there's this kind of backlash where people feel that their ways of life and food supplies in particular are too artificial. And so everyone wants natural, the organic and so on. And the genetically modified is seen as unnatural. But I mean, really, there's no scientific basis to this. It's a sort of emotional position.
Natural is kind of a myth, says Linus. Well, boom, we got this right away.
This is Dana from South Wellfleet, Massachusetts. I just want to know how much the scientist who is promoting GMOs was paid by Monsanto or anyone else in the industry.
Cynical Dana from up there in New England. It's our understanding that Mark Linus does not receive money from Monsanto, the agribusiness corporation. Lauren wrote on the website, I'm completely against GMOs. However, if it's not as bad as they say, then why not label it? As a parent, I should have the right to know what I'm feeding my family. Plain and simple, not enough unbiased research has been done. Here's Barbara Gordon writing on Facebook. Many choose to lump all genetically modified plants into just one lump and label it all evil. The potential for great evil is there, and the industry should be watched very closely, but the practice of modifying plants so they take on advantageous traits is not in itself automatically a bad thing. Many, many comments, some informed, some angry, all interested.
My name is Brett, and I'm from Eugene, Oregon. I'm very concerned about GMOs because history is full of examples of cases where the technology to detect harm from products came decades after the products came to the market. PCBs, asbestos, dioxin, and BPA are just a few examples of this. I don't want to be part of a science experiment. I don't want to be a guinea pig for the biotech industry.
This is DJ Edwards from Charleston, South Carolina. In regards to GMO foods, the bananas that we have in stores that we get to eat so abundantly for so cheap are all genetically modified. The original banana is a lot smaller and isn't as sweet. The same thing goes for seedless grapes and seedless watermelons. So I think that the word genetically modified tends to bring fear into people when really it's being modified so that more people can eat more food for better prices.
Clearly, many of our listeners read the labels and know a lot about how the food gets on their table.
My name is Pam. I'm calling from Omaha. I'm not against GMOs if you are including hybrid plants. We've been using those for decades. What I am against is ingesting tons of Roundup, which is used to drench the GMO grains, for instance. I cannot be persuaded. I don't think that that is safe.
I'm Drake calling from Detroit. My issue with genetically modified foods isn't necessarily the science or the safety. It's the fact that they're being patented, and there's no way to actually control whether or not those genes are staying in the fields where they're supposed to be. And that's causing problems for farmers who are trying to grow organic, but their fields are being contaminated.
An informed comment from Detroit there. The conversation very, very lively. Here's one from Texas, Mrs. Rowe. We aren't all crazy activists. She's a critic of GMOs. A lot of us are just moms, moms who want to rid our pantries of Monsanto's toxic garbage and be able to enjoy the bees and monarchs for a lifetime. It's so hard to know everything that's made with GMO corn or soybeans. For now, we're trying to stick with whole foods and non-GMO project verified foods. Since I can't vote for labeling yet, I'll vote weekly with my pocketbook instead. Thanks so much, and keep the conversation going. 877-8-MY-TAKE, or just go to thetakeaway.org. In just a moment, we will hear how things are going for our three friends from the Under Her Skin series on surviving breast cancer, three women making ends meet, worried about the future, and dealing with the new Affordable Care Act. Before we hear their stories, let's hear how the new health care law has changed the way people with serious illness are covered and get care. Joining us is Kirsten Sloan, Senior Policy Director for the American Cancer Society's Cancer Action Network. Kirsten, welcome.
Thank you.
So what does the Affordable Care Act do for people who have a disease like cancer? I mean, I guess it's not chronic, but it could be fatal, or it could be in remission, in which case you still have a lot of doctor visits and vigilance to be concerned with.
Well, the most important thing the Affordable Care Act does is it actually provides people with cancer access to insurance. Prior to the enactment of the ACA, if you had cancer, which was considered a pre-existing condition, insurance companies might drop you. They may impose lifetime or annual limits on the cost of your care, and they may also, at the time, they could also decide not to offer you coverage. So the fact that we now have a law that eliminates a lot of these discriminatory insurance practices means that people with cancer actually have access to affordable health insurance, and that's critical.
And knowing that you are covered means that suddenly there's an incentive to actually get mammograms and to do screenings that would catch cancer early.
That's right. And in fact, there's also a financial incentive built into the law. So things like mammography screening are provided with no copays. So what was once a financial barrier has now been eliminated.
We've seen that states have, for political reasons or other reasons, you know, modified the way the ACA is implemented. I'm thinking of the Medicaid extension. What regarding cancer would affect a coverage model state to state?
Well, right now you've got over 30 states that have expanded Medicaid, which means that a low-income person now has access to coverage that they didn't have before. So if you're that woman with breast cancer, or you're the woman who has found a lump and you're worried that you have breast cancer, you now have the ability to go to a doctor and get that checked out, to get that screening mammogram, potentially, if needed, to get that biopsy. Unfortunately, we hear every day from women in states that haven't expanded Medicaid, and their income is too high to qualify them for the standard Medicaid program, but too low for them to be able to afford insurance. And so they're falling into this gap, and unfortunately, there are very few options for them. There is one program, and it's called the Breast and Cervical Cancer Screening Program. It was created back in 1990, and it has now become a lifeline for women in states where Medicaid has not been expanded. And this program provides breast and cervical cancer screening.
And how's your experience been?
I'm very fortunate. I am a six-month breast cancer survivor. My breast cancer was caught very early through an annual mammogram, so I'm a great proponent now of mammography screening. I have good coverage. I also have the ability to take time off from work when needed. And I think when you're thinking about the financial consequences of cancer, we automatically think about costs like premiums, copays, and deductibles, all of the costs that are associated with your care. But there are some additional costs as well, and that things like drugs that may not be covered on your plan's formulary or experimental treatments that may not be covered. And then there are also non-medical considerations, and this is particularly critical for low-income women, women who may need childcare if they have to go to a doctor's appointment.
Right.
Women who work for companies that may, or organizations that may not be as generous as the American Cancer Society is with time off or flexibility.
All right. Kirsten Sloan, Senior Policy Director for the American Cancer Society's Cancer Action Network and also a six-month survivor of breast cancer. Kirsten, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Can you go another round? I will follow you down and out.
We're going to spend a few minutes now with our three friends from our radio and online series, Under Her Skin, candid, intimate audio diaries all about surviving breast cancer. Our friend Crystal Miller reminds us that you have to listen closely to folks in the thick of the fight against cancer. They often talk like accountants, not patients.
Well, I definitely spent my lunch break going over bills on the phone. I definitely spent like a good 30 minutes going over a bill that I was sent that I had already paid.
Crystal Miller sounds like she's balancing the books for a small business. And for her and the other women with breast cancer, the hard realities are often dollars and cents.
The cost of the chemo, the cost of me having my surgery, it was like $3,000 for them to put me to sleep.
I've been blessed with the copay of $5, and most of my medicine is $5, and in some cases it's been less than $5.
I was spending maybe about $25 to go to work and then about $40 to go home every day.
This is Crystal Miller's first time on the cancer journey, where doctors sometimes act like they would rather treat tumors than deal with the day-to-day human challenges of making ends meet, of life, and for veteran cancer survivor Anita Coleman, with family. There's an art, she says, to keeping the difficult moments hidden and making it all look effortless.
Trying to maintain and not let my children see any different because I wanted them to do well in school. The money was tight, but we managed, and I managed not to let them know how tight it was, because sometimes if you cut out the extra things that you really didn't need, you can make it.
Anita discovered that there is no medical treatment for losing your job. You're on your own.
This time around, I was laid off around the same time I was diagnosed, but I had relocated. My living expenses were less. And also, since I had knew I was going to be laid off, I cut out some of the extra things. And staying off from work, you just don't get to do a lot of the extra things, but it's okay because I have time to go on walks, go to the beach, just sit around and take in the simple things that I don't have a chance to take in when I'm working.
Walks on the beach. Anita doesn't need a prescription for that. But Crystal Miller learned how cancer can turn some smart choices into questionable ones in a hurry. There's a limit to good planning when it comes to cancer.
I did not plan for this, obviously. I am happy that I had a little bit of money saved. Unfortunately for me, though, like before this happened, I paid off a student loan that I had from college, which was either like $12,000 to $15,000. And I also bought a car in October. I found my lump in November, diagnosed in December. I don't know if I knew this was going to happen if I would have did those things.
A positive for both Crystal Miller and Lisa Eccles is that they are employees at the hospitals where they're being treated. Familiar surroundings, friendly coworkers, and it keeps costs down. But nothing prepares you for something like this. Who comes up with these pricing schemes, Lisa wonders, about a procedure she had back in June?
I was thinking since I had both breasts removed at the same time that they would just charge me one fee, but they charge for each breast. It was like $38,000, so it was a lot.
No discount for a double mastectomy. Lisa rolls her eyes. It's all just difficult math, trying to fit survival into the needs of a 16-year-old son still at home. Lisa has a pile for the bills to pay now and the ones that can wait. Here she is, August 15th, 2014.
It has been stressful to a certain extent because my husband having to cover majority of all the bills. So it has been pressure, but we don't have a whole lot of big bills because both our cars are paid off, and I thank God for that. But it's just the little bitty things that we try to keep up with, and some of them we can keep up with and some of them we can't, and we have to have food or have light. So we usually just pay those, and the ones that we can't pay, we just call them and say, well, we can't make a payment this month. We'll double up next month.
Since we started profiling Anita, Crystal, and Lisa, our takeaway breast cancer community has grown. We've heard stories of safety nets and financial peril from all over the country. Here's takeaway listener Kyle Shepherd talking about his mom diagnosed with breast cancer 2 years ago.
When it comes to money, we don't have a lot of it. And the state of New York, where she lives, was very gracious in paying for most of her treatment, if not all of it. And I'm fairly certain that without it, she might have given up. And that is not a prospect we were willing to entertain.
As you start adding all that stuff up, and then you come to the end of the year, and you realize that you paid out of pocket almost over $8,000. We pretty much decided, okay, well, we're just not going to be able to take a vacation probably for a couple of years. Well, cost still plays a big effect on us, and we just want to keep an eye on making sure that the doctor visits we have don't interfere with what our day-to-day needs are.
That's listener Jesse Miller from Frisco, Texas, diagnosed 4 years ago. Vacations have to wait. Life on hold. Even when insurance does what it's supposed to do, it's still a lot of work. August 22nd, 2014. Crystal Miller leans into the microphone of her audio diary and gives us all this bit of personal wisdom.
I don't know. It is what it is. And I just felt like I had to do what I had to do. And money is not everything. And, you know, I'll have to pick up the pieces later, which is fine.
Our thanks to Crystal Miller, Anita Coleman, and Lisa Eccles for sharing their stories and the personal details of their lives with breast cancer. And to our takeaway listeners who have added even more to this conversation, you can get involved by calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can join our Facebook group for this project. Just go to Facebook.com and type in Under Her Skin. And you can see the Takeaway's new interactive Under Her Skin website. Just visit thetakeaway.org.
Let's go another round. I will follow you down and down.
Talk about changing times. You know, it wasn't so long ago this was funny. Louis C.K.'s classic reminder to everyone that they should be grateful for air travel.
Did you soar into the clouds like a bird? Did you partake in the miracle of human flight? You're sitting in a chair in the sky. You're like a Greek myth right now.
But it doesn't go back very far, and it's squishing my knees. Really?
Hey, it's not funny to fly, and it's harder than ever to put yourself into the Louis C.K. state of mind with the state of air travel today. And Louis is probably doing well enough, I think, that he never has to witness the miracle of coach class ever again. Now, there's something to be grateful for. But for the rest of us, could we just have a little more space?
Hi, this is Leia calling from Dallas, Texas. I would just like a modicum of personal space. People are getting bigger, and airlines are shrinking the per-passenger allowance. Maybe they're capitalizing on the obesity epidemic to force us to pay for a couple extra inches. Maybe not, but I don't think I ever sat this close to even my own siblings in the back seat. Thanks.
This is Valerie Wells from Dallas, Texas. My peeve about airlines is allowing the people who sit in front of you to recline to the point where the person behind them has no space, not even to lower their tray, and feels miserable. And the people that are reclining feel like that's their right.
Hey, in the last 9 days, three planes were diverted because of fights that resulted from people reclining their seats. What's the solution? Padded cabin, horse tranquilizers, laughing gas, straitjackets? I'm not a designer or an aviation expert. So we found two people who are. Barbara Peterson is an expert. She's aviation correspondent for Condé Nast Traveler. Bastian Schaefer is a designer, innovation manager, in fact, with the airplane manufacturer Airbus. Bastian says when it comes to comfort versus profits, comfort often stays on the drawing board.
We have a worldwide network of companies who innovate with us. And of course, we team up with them to find new ideas. But specifically in the course of seat design, we have seat suppliers, and those suppliers are directly contracted by the airline. So at least it could happen that the airline comes around and says, we want to have a certain kind of seat, which we have to install then.
So the airline says you have to use this tiny little torture seat, and you really can't do much about that as a designer, right?
Exactly. So this is the decision of the airline, finally.
All right, Barbara, so it seems like the priority is just to make seats smaller. And while there might be, you know, nicer nuts and pretzels, I'm not seeing a lot of design and comfort innovation in airline cabins these days.
Yes. And really what influences the way you feel on a plane is not just the seat. The seat is a very important part of it. And you're absolutely right that the trend in recent years has been to slim them down, literally, not the passengers, of course, but the seats themselves, to make them lighter. And what's happened is those slimline seats also have the advantage from the airline standpoint that more of them can be put on a plane. That's sort of driving this trend. But I must say the other thing and the reason why we're seeing these incidents now is, first of all, there's a higher percentage of those seats being filled. The load factor, which is the number of seats that are filled on average, has gone up from 56% right around the time of deregulation to more than 82%.
So the seats are not, you know, terribly comfortable to begin with on an empty plane, but you pack in, you know, 80%, 90%, and it's just that much worse.
Yes, and that really is partly what's leading to these fights in the air.
Now, Barbara, is there etiquette associated with reclining your seat? I mean, I get the impression that on an airline, all you're concerned about as a passenger is what's in front of you, your bags under the seats, your stuff in the overhead bin. But behind you, you don't care at all. There could be spikes on the back of your seat and you just recline it.
Yes, unless someone's kicking your seat, I guess you really don't want to know what's behind. No, that is a real problem. There really is no etiquette. I've never even seen any, you know, recommendations on how to behave on a plane. That's just not part of the travel experience. So consequently, if you want to recline your seat, you do have a right to do that.
And there's different ways of reclining your seat. There's the recline that's kind of the, I'm relaxed, the sort of polite recline. Then there's the, oh, great, this thing works, you know, it's a little firmer. And then there's the person who's so mad who just, boom, to hell with you behind me. And that can cause fights.
Yes, absolutely. There is a way. You know, I think that the airlines, in addition to the safety videos or drills, they might want to actually come out with a little etiquette lecture at the beginning.
Bastian, do you understand what we're talking about here with this reclining business?
Absolutely. And I see different approaches there. And there are already seats available which do not have a recline anymore. So these seats have a different angle of the backrest so that the passenger is sitting more comfortable. The companies, the seat suppliers are working on different concepts to solve this issue.
Have you ever heard of this knee defender thing that you prop into the back of a seat that keeps it from reclining?
No, I never heard about
Barbara,
this.
Have you heard of this?
Oh, yes. And actually, sales have skyrocketed since these recent episodes. But the irony is that, of course, most airlines will ban them precisely because it leads to this sort of rage in the air.
Yeah.
And diversions of flights, which are very expensive, actually, to the airlines. So this is not a good trend. I think it's pretty hostile, actually, to use those knee defenders. However, I do think that we do really need to move to the next phase, which is maybe a seat that doesn't recline in the old way. Those seats were really, that basic concept goes back to the 1960s. And so, you know, the new seat designs really need to reflect the new reality of flying.
And it's not as though the recline is anything serious. I mean, it's, you know, maybe 6 degrees. I mean, in business class, you got real reclining. I mean, in first class, you've got beds. So
yes.
Forget about it in coach. Bastian, any solution here besides the no recline? Anything you can do to make it comfortable, maybe a lumbar support, I don't know, nitrous oxide in the cabin, something?
We have a huge range of different ideas. But on the other hand, due to the regulations, not all of them become reality. So there are some strange ideas like 3D seating inside the cabin. Yeah, so to use the space up on your head to increase the seat pitch or the space for your legs. But this requires to think in another dimension. But I think we are far from a certification. It's just an idea.
3D seating. I'm trying to picture that. I mean, I wouldn't be floating up in the overhead compartment, would I?
Well, we would have to deal with the luggage in another manner. So maybe you do not have hand luggage anymore because it's stored somewhere in the cargo compartment and you leave your hand luggage just right in the entrance area of the airplane and put it into a cargo compartment.
So get rid of the overhead, strap yourself into some kind of sort of mummy outfit, then you can sort of stand in a kind of floating position?
I guess you don't need this mummy outfit. I think there are solutions available to also here to make a nice travel journey for you.
Bastian Schaefer is Innovation Manager for Airbus Cabin Innovation Strategy and Concepts Department, speaking to us from Hamburg. Bastian, thanks.
Thank you.
Any hope, Barbara?
Yes, well, there are actually some good ideas that are actually now in the market. There is this, what they call convertible seats, which actually can be expanded or contracted depending on how the airline wants to configure the seat. So it could be, three seats together or just two. So then there is something called the herringbone, which means that some people are facing forward, some people are facing back. That tends to create more of a sense of space. I mean, there are things to do within the confines of the aircraft cabin, which isn't exactly, you know, a great space to be working with.
That's for sure. Barbara Peterson is aviation correspondent for Condé Nast Traveler. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And please adjust your seat into the upright lock position in preparation for landing. If you want to listen back to anything on the show, check us out at thetakeaway.org, but only when it's safe to turn your personal electronic devices back on. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.